This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Start with an unprecedented number of mail-in ballots. Add one vacancy on the Supreme Court. Fold in 13 battleground states and garnish with a president who won't commit to accepting the results. This is the recipe for a historically chaotic presidential election. According to a recent Yahoo News YouGov poll, only 22% of Americans believe the election will be free and fair. So things could get even more chaotic if, in the days and weeks after the election, we still don't know who won. Joining me this hour to help us navigate through all the possible twists and turns of the presidential election is Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitutional Center and a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. Jeffrey, it's great to have you back on the show.
It's great to be back.
Also with us is Benjamin L. Ginsburg, an elections lawyer who has advised Republican candidates and served as national counsel to the Bush, Cheney, and Romney for president campaigns. Benjamin, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And rounding out our panel is Liz Goodwin. She's the deputy bureau chief for the Boston Globe in Washington. Liz, welcome to 1A.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Benjamin, we've heard so many potential outcomes of the presidential election, from the Supreme Court determining the outcome to the House of Representatives making the call. How prepared should we be for any of these situations?
Well, I think we should be prepared for any and all situations. But in doing the preparations, we should also remember the lessons of history, which is, in the vast majority of cases, we do know a winner on election night. The chances of it not being known on election night is probably higher than ever. And the chaotic, potentially chaotic situation you outlined means we should prepare for things we thought were unthinkable.
So how concerned are you, though, that even after we have all the votes counted, that we still won't have a clear result?
About three times in the 57 presidential elections we've had, there have been recounts or post-election disputes that required some sort of extra determination to figure out. So I'd say it's about 5.2% likelihood.
Is there a chance that a candidate could claim victory on election night?
Yes, of course. The results could dictate that. And even aside from this particular election cycle, candidates often go through a bit of a dance in which they claim an election night victory, whether it's justified or not. So that won't be anything new particularly.
Well, Liz, we got this message from Maria on Facebook who writes, "My concern is how the news outlets will be reporting the results. Maybe include a caption to preface results with a disclaimer, or better yet, don't report any results until all ballots are counted. Trump is expecting news sources to report results as they come in." Your thoughts about Maria's, you know, thinking around how the media is going to report this?
That's a great point. And I do feel like the media is pretty tuned in to this issue that, you know, Americans are used to turning on the news, watching the returns come in, and basically knowing the winner by midnight. And that is way less likely this year than ever before, because way more people than ever before are expected to mail in their ballots, and it takes longer to count those. So I think that a lot of networks are already thinking this through, and they're going to be very careful to explain how many ballots they expect have, you know, are not part of the count, that this is only the in-person total. I think you're going to see the media being very alert to that perception and making sure they're not playing into what President Trump is trying to say, which is that only election day results are valid, because that's just not true.
Jeffrey, historically, how often are American presidential elections contested?
Well, Benjamin Ginsburg gave us the sense that it was in about three where the ties were so close that they led to huge litigation. The most recent precedents, of course, are 2000, which many of us remember well, and 1876. And both of those were elections where the swing states sent two competing ballots, and it was up to Congress to determine which one to count. In 2000, of course, Florida had two slates, and it went to Congress, and ultimately the Supreme Court decided in favor of President Bush. The great fear here is that we could see the same thing happening in several states if the president's supporters contested the validity of mail-in ballots. There are some scenarios that some state legislatures might recall their ability to appoint electors, claiming that they were giving voice to the will of the people. And you could have two slates in several states, one certified by the state legislature and the other by the Democratic governor. And then what happens is a very complicated path that all turns on a federal law called the Electoral Count Act, which some folks may remember from Bush v. Gore. And it's a very convoluted law that sets forth a procedure for how to count between two ballots. And the bottom line is, in the end, the House and Senate may have to vote on which ballot to accept. And if they tie and can't agree, then the executive of the state is supposed to decide, and which means the governor, unless the Supreme Court steps in. So the big question, of course, is will the Supreme Court step in? And I'll just venture, and none of us knows because it all would depend on the way that these cases were presented, that intervening in a contested election is the last thing that Chief Justice Roberts would want to do. He has made institutional legitimacy the cornerstone of his chief justiceship. I believe, without knowing, of course, that he and I would imagine many of the justices want to avoid a repeat of Bush v. Gore, and they will do everything possible to avoid casting a definitive vote, especially along party lines, to decide a contested election.
Well, Republicans are determined to confirm President Trump's Supreme Court pick, Amy Coney Barrett, before the election. Liz, what do we know about how voters, specifically Republican voters, feel about this, given that it's in direct contrast to the GOP's refusal to confirm President Obama's pick during the 2016 election year?
Well, unsurprisingly, in such a polarized climate that we're in, most Republican voters do support the president's desire to get his pick in, despite there being a bit of a flip-flop on that, given what happened to Merrick Garland. Overall, though, a majority of voters believe that the next president should choose the next Supreme Court justice. So it is unpopular overall, but a majority of Republicans have Trump's back on that move.
You know, Jeffrey, the president is hoping Amy Coney Barrett will give him an edge if the decision goes to the Supreme Court. Top Democrats have called for Barrett to commit to recusing herself from issues that involve the outcome of the election. What happens if this lands in front of the Supreme Court? And as you mentioned with this question about the court's legitimacy.
So the court does not have to intervene. And in fact, the Electoral Count Act in 1876 was passed with the specific purpose of keeping justices out of contested elections. And the founders said that they hoped that courts would not decide contested elections. So it would be easy for the court to say, this is not our job and it's up to Congress to decide. If the court did feel compelled to intervene, and of course they have intervened in recent election cases, including the one in Wisconsin last spring, which was a 5-4 vote where the court split about whether postmarked ballots could be counted or not, the Chief Justice will do everything possible to ensure that it's not 6-3 or 5-4 or whatever the number is. So, I could be entirely wrong about this, but the president's hope that a single justice would throw the election to him on a partisan vote seems like the last thing that this Supreme Court would want, and it might either seek unanimity around a result that all sides could accept, or stay out of the issue entirely. The Supreme Court is not compelled to get involved, and if it's going to split on partisan lines, I think it will try not to.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but we'll have more right after this, so stay close. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Google. Since 2017, Google has helped 5 million Americans learn digital skills through Grow with Google. With Google's free Applied Digital Skills courses, job seekers can expand their skill sets, boost their resumes, and power their job searches. And with Google Career Certificates, people can learn job-ready skills to start or advance their careers in high-demand fields like IT support with no prior experience required. Get tools and resources to grow your career at google.com/grow.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
There are these networks of staunchly pro-gun groups on Facebook. And one of them is run by these three brothers, the Door Brothers. But it turns out, they don't just do guns. The Door family name has been attached to other causes.
Their goal is to eliminate public education and to replace it with Christian schooling.
The Roots of the Door Family on the No Compromise podcast from NPR.
I'm Jen White, and this is 1A. My guests are veteran elections attorney Benjamin Ginsburg, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, Jeffrey Rosen, and the Boston Globe's Liz Goodwin. We're talking to them about what happens after November 3rd. Liz, what are the prospects of Vice President Biden winning the popular vote but losing the Electoral College?
I think they're very high. We saw that happen in 2016. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by about 3 million votes and lost the Electoral College in a way that wasn't even close, right? We didn't have these recount situation. It was pretty clear that she lost the Electoral College vote. So you see that these widening disparities between the popular vote Electoral College outcome, which we're not really used to as a nation, that's only happened five times before, two in the past 20 years. And I think it's entirely possible that that could happen again this time.
We are talking about some of the legal cases that could emerge. But before we get there, Ed tweets, Republicans used their wave election in 2010 to lock in permanently gerrymandered majorities, leaving them big majorities in state legislatures, even when Democratic candidates are getting more votes statewide. Those gerrymandered protected legislators have passed laws stripping away the powers of newly elected Democratic governors. Now those gerrymandered legislators will try to appoint their own electors for VP Pence to recognize on January 6th. This will be a coup d'etat that will mark the end of the American experiment in constitutional democracy. How much of a concern is this for you, Jeffrey, as you watch this election?
Well, it's of great constitutional concern because it's not clear that state legislatures have the power to take back the ability to appoint electors after they've already delegated them to be decided by the winner of the popular vote. Each state has different rules for how they allocate their electoral votes. Most are winner take all. A few, like Maine and Nebraska, are proportional. But the idea that the state legislatures, having delegated this power, could seize it back and appoint their own slate is not clear. So that by itself would, of course, be challenged. Ultimately, I think, though, it wouldn't be resolved in a court, but it would be resolved by Congress's decision about which slate to count, unless the Supreme Court, and this is really the nightmare situation for all sides, I think, because no one would want this election to be decided by the court on partisan lines. In the end, the Supreme Court could decide whether or not the state legislatures have the power to recall their authority to appoint electors.
Well, Luna emails, President Trump has already begun sowing doubt in his supporters' minds. If he loses the election, I'm worried that people will take to the streets and riots could turn violent for days to come. I hope most Americans will keep faith in the process and accept the results. Benjamin, President Trump has been strongly against mail-in voting. He tweeted Monday, quote, "The ballots being returned to states cannot be accurately counted. Many things are already going very wrong," end quote. In an op-ed for the Washington Post, you wrote that there is insufficient evidence to support his claims of a rigged and fraudulent election. Tell us more about why you wrote this op-ed.
I wrote the op-ed because I've been a Republican election lawyer for a little too close to four decades. And one of the traditional functions that we perform is the poll watching program is permitted by all the state's laws. So that there have been Republicans in any polling place where we wanted to be, there have been certainly efforts to amass incidents of fraud that happens in recounts and contests all the time. It is important to be honest about the evidence that has been gathered and amassed. And there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud. There is, to be sure, occasional instances of fraud perpetrated by both parties. But it's important to be honest about the evidence that has been gathered and what it can show. And President Trump is the first president to say that our elections are fraudulent or rigged or there's a scam. And what prompted me to write the column was that I don't think a president of the United States ought to be saying things like that without rock solid evidence, and it's nowhere close to rock solid.
You know, Liz, the president is also trying to sow distrust in the mail-in voting system. There have been concerns about the postal service. Where do things stand right now?
Yeah, that's what is sort of complicated about the situation right now, because, you know, as Ben said, we've never had a president saying that the election is going to be riddled with fraud, things like that. And that's kind of the worry there, is that's eroding people's trust in the system. But at the same time, there are reasons to be concerned, right, that are fact-based. And one of those reasons to be concerned are mail delays that we've seen. And in the Florida primary just this August, you know, thousands of ballots arrived too late to be counted because of mail delays. So this is something that's happening that people need to be concerned about. And that's why I think both parties are sending out the message, vote as early as possible. If you're going to send in your ballot by mail, get it in as early as possible so you aren't affected by these delays. And, you know, the House, which is controlled by Democrats, has been trying to keep fire to the feet of the post service to explain these delays. And the president, meanwhile, has kind of reveled in the fact that Nancy Pelosi hasn't been able to get more money to the post office, because he said that means they can't use mail-in ballots. So he clearly sees any effort to starve the Postal Service of funds as strategic. And that's also just uncharted territory for all of us.
But it's important to note that Republicans vote by mail. So is President Trump doing himself a disservice here?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, Trump himself voted by mail in the Florida primary, which was kind of the ultimate irony. And Florida in general, their mail-in ballots have skewed older and more conservative. That's not the case in every state, but in Florida it has been. And, you know, there were Republicans there who were begging his team to get him to cool it on his rhetoric. And he did eventually send out a tweet saying, oh, in Florida it's safe. Because they were worried it would hurt them in the election. I think now when you look at polling, it's really shocking how polarized by party mail-in is now. Democrats are so much more likely to say they plan to vote by mail than Republicans are. And it's really unclear that is the best strategy for the president politically.
We got this email from Jill, who asks, will the Congress that may decide the election on January 6th, 2021, be comprised of current congresspeople or the newly elected Congress? Jeffrey?
It's the current congresspeople. There might be one or two additions, like the Arizona senator in a special election if the Democrat wins. But generally, it is the outgoing Congress which makes the politics of this all the more fraught.
Well, a member of the 1A Text Club asks, how do we prevent a constitutional crisis that rivals the Bush-Gore challenge? Jeffrey, is it preventable at this point?
You know, first I want to make sure, forgive me, I want to correct my last answer, which was wrong. It's actually the new Congress. I just checked. The third day of January is when the newly elected Congress is seated, and the sixth day of January, when the House and Senate meet jointly, is when the electoral ballots are counted. So it's the new Congress, but Vice President Pence is still presiding over it, because he, of course, is vice president until January 20th, when the new president is inaugurated. How to prevent a Bush v. Gore situation? It all comes down, as Liz Goodwin says, to some things that are out of people's control, like how much dispute there is about late arriving ballots, about postmarks, about contested signatures. One thing we know is that courts are reluctant to change the rule at the last minute, or at least the Supreme Court is. In the Wisconsin case in the spring, it invoked something called the Purcell principle. It was a case called Purcell versus Gonzalez in 2006, which basically said courts shouldn't change election rules just before the election, because that could confuse voters and create problems for officials. So that means that any lower courts that change the rules for counting ballots right before the election, after the ballots are already in, could face the possibility of Supreme Court reversal. That's why it's so urgently important for states to have established their rules in advance, as Liz said, for people to vote early and to try to avoid as many last-minute challenges as possible. But a Bush v. Gore situation like the 1876 situation is just a perfect storm where the swing states, and there are just a handful of them, are so close that it's not clear who won. And if that happens, God save the United States of America.
We're discussing the possibility of a contested presidential election in November. My guests are veteran elections attorney Benjamin Ginsburg, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, Jeffrey Rosen, and the Boston Globe's Liz Goodwin. Megan emails, "I'm not particularly concerned that there won't be a clear winner, but I am terrified that it won't matter and there will be deep unrest and chaos if Trump refuses to accept the results." I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Land I Trust, a podcast from the Sierra Club featuring people sharing their experiences with climate and justice issues. This season brings unique stories of energy transition and community transformation amidst the growing movement for environmental, racial, and climate justice. Listen to season 4 of The Land I Trust on sc.org/stories, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Radio Ambulante is NPR's only Spanish-language podcast. Listen for stories you won't hear anywhere else, told by the voices that make Latin America come alive. Each week, we bring you another remarkable story that will surprise and move you. Radio Ambulante, new episodes every Tuesday. Listen and subscribe.
Let's get back to our conversation about what happens if there isn't a clear winner of the presidential election. My guests are veteran elections attorney Benjamin Ginsburg, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, Jeffrey Rosen, and the Boston Globe's Liz Goodwin. Benjamin, it was over a month before President Bush was declared the winner over Al Gore in 2000. And for those of us who are old enough to remember, those were some pretty stressful weeks. Are there lessons learned from Bush v. Gore that could make a contested election move a little more quicker this time?
Well, how quickly it moves is really dependent on the laws of the state where it takes place. So I think that after Bush versus Gore, some states did learn the lesson and revised their recount and contest laws, and others didn't. I do think it's important when we're talking about parallels between 2000 and what might happen in 2020 is to realize that 2020 is unlikely to be like Bush versus Gore. That was one state with improbably close returns that meant the difference in the election. 2020 is going to be much more about the onset of absentee ballots and how that's going to slow down the ability of many states to be able to produce quick returns, so that if you're waiting a week or 2 weeks for those returns, then you may find out that you have a situation as close as Bush versus Gore. But in 2000, we knew the certified results, or not the certified results, but the official results in about 3 days, and that launched the recounts and contests. That stands to be a much more delayed time frame in 2020. Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey, in a letter to Democrats over the weekend, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi warned them to prepare for the possibility that the House will decide the election. What would it take to trigger that?
Well, there are two possibilities, at least. One is the contested ballot situation that we saw in Bush v. Gore. If that had gone to Congress, then the House and Senate would vote about which electoral ballots to count. The other situation is that if neither candidate gets a majority in the Electoral College, according to the 12th Amendment, passed after the contested election of 1800, which I guess is the third on the list that Benjamin Ginsburg first flagged for us, the 12th Amendment says if there's no majority in the Electoral College, then it goes to the House, and each House delegation has one vote. So that's why Republicans are saying that would be good for President Trump because there'd be one vote per state. But those are at least two situations where the House could decide the election.
Liz, was this a tactical political move by the Speaker of the House, or is there actual concern that the decision of the election would lie there?
Oh, I think there is I think it's a real concern. Yeah. And I think the Speaker, you know, right now, Republicans, if this vote, this hypothetical vote were held right now, they have 26 votes because it basically goes by whoever has the most members of Congress from a state gets the vote. So it's almost like they become a mini Senate or half of a mini Senate. So because they're only down one, I think she sees it as within their grasp to expand their majority and on the delegation level. And so, yeah, this is a real thing that Democrats want to try to pick up a seat here or there if it means it would flip a whole delegation, because this election is just, you know, so unprecedented in every way that it's worth it to be prepared for that scenario.
I want to hear from both of you, Jeffrey and Benjamin. How long is too long to wait for an election result based both on what the Constitution says and what you think our democracy can handle right now? Benjamin?
The question of what the country can stand right now is, I think, one of those you have to kind of wait and see. We are certainly in a more fragile state about our elections than I think we ever have been. And that stands to indeed create some problems. I mean, as an electoral matter, what's particularly interesting about the Barrett nomination is both parties agree that it's energized their bases. That means, I think, that these kind of sleeping giants in the suburbs that the Democrats have wanted to get to participate at a higher rate stand to get turned up. And of course, that means that the suburban districts that Democrats won in 2018 will be much harder for Republicans to recapture in 2020, which goes to the number of state delegations that can be counted on as either Democratic or Republican votes. Hence, Speaker Pelosi sending out her letter and the intrigue that could come from that. Of course, you may not know who won the delegation in a particular state for a number of days or weeks, just like you won't know about the presidential contest, again, adding to the stress involved.
Jeffrey, your thoughts. Again, what do you think our democracy can handle?
Well, the Constitution says January 20th is the date the president has to be inaugurated. So that's the final deadline. And the question of what's too long is partly dependent on, you know, whose side you're on. In 2000, one of the Supreme Court's big reasons for getting involved was that the country couldn't handle a protracted period of uncertainty. We had to have a stable presidential transition, and therefore it was best just to create stability by cutting off the recount and favoring one side rather than the other. I'm not convinced, like many people, that that was the right decision. If the election had proceeded and gone to Congress the way the Electoral Count Act anticipated, the definitive recount done by the media organization suggests that President Bush would have won anyway. And in the end, the state executive would have decided. So the punchline was that Jeb Bush really had the final authority to choose among the ballots. But the Supreme Court took a big hit for its legitimacy for jumping in. Certainly, were the Supreme Court to jump in this time on the theory that the country needed stability and to decide the election on a contested basis, like a 6-3 vote, that would be catastrophic for the court's legitimacy. It would almost certainly provoke efforts for court packing if Vice President Biden and the Democrats won, and it could be a real crisis of legitimacy, which goes back to my initial thought that the Supreme Court will want to avoid that and stay out of it. And that may mean we need to be ready for a longer period of uncertainty that could even stretch into January than we otherwise had thought.
a member of our text club says, I want to know what protections are in place to ensure a peaceful transition of power that do not count on the good faith of the party or candidate leaving the office. Another person asks, what agency is responsible for removing Trump from the White House when he refuses to leave? I want to get that second question answered first, but it's clear that people are worried about this. And Benjamin, do you have concern about your party and what this means for your party longer term?
Well, I do have some concerns longer term, the positions that this is putting the party. I suppose the answer to the question of how you would actually remove a recalcitrant president from the White House is lawyers would have to dive into the law of adverse possession in the District of Columbia and try and remember that. The damage to the party long term by the president's statements take a number of different forms. It puts Republican senators dealing with the Barrett confirmation in the uncomfortable position of having to deal with what the president said about his election, when Republican senators would, I think, prefer to look at what it means to have a conservative 6-3 majority for a number of decades on the Supreme Court. So they're dealing with an issue they don't want to. As you mentioned at the outset, the party is engaged in over 40 election litigation cases around the country. They're all rooted in protections to stop fraud. The president's comments will shine a much brighter spotlight on the need to produce evidence of that. I don't believe that evidence exists. So the party risks taking a number of losses in courts around the country. And thirdly is the poor Republican candidate up by a slight margin in the post-election will have to deal with the president's own assertions that the election was fraudulent or rigged to try and hang on to his or her own lead. So those are some long-term serious implications for the party, which is supposed to be an ongoing institution.
Jeffrey, very briefly, what agency is responsible for removing a sitting president if he's voted out of office but refuses to leave?
I have to confess, I don't know the answer to that question. I imagine that the U.S. Military, in the end, is sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States, but they have to take their orders from the commander-in-chief as long as he remains in office. So after January 20th, if Vice President Biden were elected, then perhaps he could so order. But let's not engage in absolutely apocalyptic scenarios like this one, because they may not be constructive. But one of our guests may know better than I, but I don't believe that the U.S. government has an agency tasked with forcibly removing a president from office.
I don't know if anyone else wants to chime in here.
I don't know the answer either, but I know that there's this group, the Transition Integrity Project, which is a bipartisan group of experts and former elected officials, and they've war-gamed out different scenarios with this election. And they had a scenario in which the president had to be removed by the Secret Service at the end of the day. That was one of four totally imaginary scenarios they cooked up. And I don't know if that's because that's how it would actually happen by law, or if they just decided that was the most likely scenario.
Well, Jeffrey, at a time when people's trust in institutions is low, can you leave us with any closing thoughts that can maybe encourage people?
Well, we've just seen the tremendous importance of these institutions and their fragility. And it's so easy when people lose trust in the institutions of American government to have apocalyptic talk like taking to the streets. And that's why it's so urgently important to maintain faith both in the institutions and in the constitutional process. It's the Constitution that binds us. It sets forth procedures for civil disagreement, for disagreeing without being disagreeable, for peaceful transitions of power. It's so important not to attack the institutions that enforce the Constitution, including and primarily the courts, which is why it's so urgently important that the courts maintain their legitimacy. And we must maintain these binds that unite we the people, because they are what define us as a nation.
We've been speaking with Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, veteran elections lawyer Benjamin L. Ginsburg, and Liz Goodwin, deputy bureau chief for the Boston Globe in Washington. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Sharla Freeland. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. And let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.